Duke Ellington said, Louis Armstrong is, of course, the man who, when heard playing trumpet, inspired thousands of people to try to play like him, to play the Louis Armstrong style. I was one of those thousands. And hundreds of thousands were simply inspired to play the same instrument he played. And who knows how many millions just loved to listen to him. Louis Armstrong is what I call an American standard, an American original. Duke Ellington. Those were nice words, Pops.
Yeah, I enjoyed that on your tape the other night, the other one you gave me.
Yeah.
Yeah, Duke always say nice things. That's my man anyway, you know.
You did an album with the Duke some years back.
Sure did.
And you did one with Ella?
Well, I did several with Ella. You know.
I think it would be a great idea for Las Vegas to have you and Ella reunite on the stage here. This has been a great engagement with Pearl Bailey.
Yeah, but I worked more with Ella anyway. You know, we did two albums together. Very good. And then a lot of time we meet in New York. She opened at with a big hotel there on Park Avenue there.
At the Waldorf.
The Waldorf, and that was the opening night, and I got up on stage with her. And wherever she's playing, I always get up. You know, she was in Carter Barron in Washington. You know, wherever it is, I get up and we do a little something. You know, a tune I like that I did with Ella years ago was You Won't Be Satisfied, you remember?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, good old girl.
Well, you know, Ella was at Decca at the same time that you were recording with Milt Gabler.
Yeah.
And of course, the days in Harlem when Ella was discovered by Chick Webb and kind of grew up with the band.
I remember.
And then took over the band when Chick passed on.
I remember when she's a little bit of a girl in her teenage days.
She's a lovely lady, Ella.
Yes, and we used to run into each other on one-night stands and everything.
Yeah,
if I have a night off, I always catch her concerts. She's my gal.
Well, you don't mind if we start a little campaign in our column and on our radio and our television to see if we can't get you to come back here maybe in the spring with
anytime,
Ella.
Anytime, yeah. With Ella, anybody. But I like Ella because we understand each other so well, you know.
You know, when we first talked, you were 3 days into the engagement, and now you're 10 days into the engagement. You have just a couple of days left. How do you feel after two shows a night and blowing the horn in public again?
You're back home, you know, we usually say back in the salt mines again. Well, I mean, it's my life. I look forward to things like that.
I have to repeat one remark you made the last time we talked. You said, we talked about your 54 years of playing and all the one-nighters, and you said, if I had taken better care of myself, I'd be in better shape today. I don't see how, Pops.
Well, that's what we all feel, you know, musicians and performers. You'd have to say those things because you take for instance, you can go to work so tired from balling the night before and riding the bus and different things. And right after the concert, you get just as fresh and go somewhere. And then you look around, you're out again. You know. Well, I tricked everybody because I took my Swiss Chris every night and kept my system clean, you know.
You know, there's a famous lady who does the same thing, Mae West.
Well, she's smart. She's smart. Because it's no use carrying liquor from yesterday, 3 or 4 days, when you can have fresh liquor, fresh food, and different things. That's what I look at. It's my psychology.
You know, Louis, of all the places that you've played, of all the engagements, is there one that stands out in your mind? One place, one time?
Well, in my life?
Yes.
Yeah, when I joined Joe Oliver. At the Royal Garden Blues, at the Royal Garden in Chicago. I think that's one of the highlights of my life.
How did Joe send for you? Did he send you a letter, or how did they get in touch?
Sent a telegram. I received a telegram at the cemetery when I was playing with the Tuxedo Brass Band, and we just burying one of the brothers, you know, and I get this wire, and I told Celestin that I'm going.
Did he send money too?
Well, he had sent everything. So I told Celestin, I said, well, that's my idol, you know, and he sent for me. And he said, I don't see what you want to go up there because right now Joe Oliver's band is scabbing, you know, at the Rug, at Lincoln Garden. They was on strike and the union had put them out and all that. So and you don't go into that. I said, wherever Joe Oliver is, I want to go. I don't care what he's doing.
I read in the account.
And they tried their best to keep me down there. I said, no, Joe Oliver's in with me.
I read in the account in Life magazine of how when you were a little one, you followed Joe Oliver around, and sometimes you got to carry his trumpet case.
That's right. And then the policeman couldn't run me out the parade. Because I was my man, and it still is. I sing a song every night about him.
That's right. You tell the whole story of your career in song.
That's right. All the boys were nice, don't get me wrong. But Joe, in my young days, he took more time with the kids that was trying to prove something than all the rest of them. Fine trumpet, cornet players. There were no trumpets.
Well, you played cornet when you first came up to Chicago.
They all played cornet in the early days. But
was there one trumpet player or cornet player that influenced you more than any other?
Well, I don't think not New Orleans days. I think Joe Oliver was my man, and they all were great. But I don't know. It was something about him. He was creative, and the riffs you hear, this five-part brass playing and things like that. All that's King Oliver. I'm sorry.
When was it? In the 60s or in the late 50s, you recreated a lot of those recordings that you made with Joe King Oliver. And I think Yank Lawson and Billy Butterfield worked with you on that.
Yeah, he did.
In fact, Yank played the King Oliver parts.
Yeah, that autobiography. Yank did all of the solos that King Oliver played. And I okayed him because he played them very good. Yeah.
Well, you know, one of the things that happened, I guess it was in the 40s, they rediscovered Bunk Johnson, and they brought Bunk up to New York City to Stuyvesant Casino.
Right.
How was Bunk as a trumpet player in his early days?
Well, Bunk was always a gem. Yeah, he was great. Bunk, Buddy Petit, Manny Perez, Kimball, and Freddie Kepper, they were all gems, man, you know. But to me, King Oliver was the boss.
He was the
in
boss.
A parade, I tell you, he was a character. The brass band would have on the uniforms, and Joe had a handkerchief on his neck, you know, from his cap to keep the sun off his neck while he's blowing. And he was blowing too much when he'd reach up there and play them St. Louis blues.
You knocked me out in a statement that I read once. You said that he was also the champion at missing those little piles on the street as he was marching along.
He'd be reading those cards, you know, I'd be playing a march, and I know he could look at the notes and see that big waddle on the street. He'd bump and then step aside and miss that baby. And that killed me. We did that in the Newport Festival, the jazz festival. They had the brass band from New Orleans. Mm-hmm. And they all remember Joe Oliver doing that. And it knocked Tyree out to see us walk over that puddle there.
That's funny. You know, Bunk's band, some of the men who were in that band in 48 were great men through the years in New Orleans, men like George Lewis and Slow Drag.
Would you believe that I didn't know those fellas when I was in New Orleans?
Really?
Well, I left young. When I first left New Orleans, 1919.
When you went up with King Oliver, was that your first time in Chicago?
I'm trying to tell you.
Oh.
I left with Fate Marable in 1919 on the boats, on the river boats, all up to St. Louis and Alton and Bick's home there, Davenport,
Iowa.
And that's where the boats used to go for the winter, and they had a little chute there, and we'd go up and get on the boat. That's where I met Bick's, this little young fella come on the boat that night. You know, and he blew the horn, and then he played the pianos up there, and went in Chicago. We met from then on.
You and he became very good friends.
Yeah, and when I played with Joe Glazer at the Sunset, 1926, 27, he was with Paul Whiteman at the Chicago Theater, and after he finished his show, right where he come, where I played, you know. And we waited all the people leave, and we locked the doors and jammed.
Then you played for your fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We did play.
How would you rank Bunny Berrigan in among
Bunny,
the...
Bunny was my man, too. I wrote an article on Bunny. He can't do no wrong.
Yeah, he was a great man. He left
he
too soon.
He played beautifully, and he had a good tone. So anybody with a good tone and sense of raising, you know, I hear a million of them, and I don't say anything. I'm just a prerogative. They want to play jiu-jitsu music or something. That's their business, you know. But Bunny was my boy. and quite nicely Bix in the early days. But don't forget Bonnie Bagger and something else.
Yeah, he was. I felt that.
And I would play that tune. I loved he played so well.
I can't get started.
No. Let the trombone play. Somebody asked for it, don't let him play it. I respect Bonnie that well. Not that I couldn't play it, but you don't do those things when you admire somebody.
You know, you had a long and a very successful big band period. Then I guess it was 1947 when you went back to the All-Stars.
Yeah, good band.
Jack Teagarden was on that band. When did you first meet Jack?
Well, when I first met Jack, it was in New Orleans. He came down to get some musicians from Houston, Texas. And he was playing with Peck Kelly. You know Peck Kelly.
In Houston.
He's something like a god to all the Ophir musicians. They love Peck Kelly. So he sent down there to pick up a few musicians. And Jack was standing on the banks of the river as the steamer Sydney was packing out. And some guys said, that's Jack Lee. I hadn't heard him play. And Jack played in Harlem one night. And he come up there with his overcoat turned up and his cap turned up. And he said one thing, he said, well, all these cats, I want to cut him. And he did.
Oh, yeah, he played. Well, let's see, Jack Teagarden, I think Barney Bagard was with you in that
band.
Well,
no, Barney was with Duke Voice.
Yeah, but didn't he come with that band in 47 with Jack Teagarden?
Oh, it was 47.
Yeah, when you formed the All-Stars.
I'm talking way back now, around 25.
So you and Jack had known each other for 20-some years.
Yeah, well,
you were
on the boat in 1919 with Fate Maple, mm-hmm. way back then. But I didn't play with him, you know what I mean? I just knew about him. But when he come to New York, he cut every brother ever living, you know?
His brother Charlie lives here in town. His brother Charlie's a good trumpet player.
He was good. He was good here. I mean, he played for a long time. He just put it down. Because when he put it down, he was good. You know what I mean?
Right till he decided to go full-time.
Got tired traveling and different things. Don't forget, Charlie always was a good man. And my wife, Lucille, was in the show with Charlie Teagarden.
I didn't know that.
Flying Colors or something like that for a long time.
When did you meet Lucille?
Well, in the Cotton Club days. She was had that front line, and I'm blowing around at them buns there. She was swinging there, you know.
When did you and Lucille get married?
Oh, I don't know. We must have jived around about 6 months or a year. See how it happened, you know, in Cotton Club, the chorus clubs, they always had make up a pool for the cabs. Cag Johnson and the boys with cabs, band and thing, they'd make a pool and a couple of chorus clubs would go uptown and they save money like that. Well, at that time, Joe Cleese had that brand new Cadillac packet for me, you know, and chauffeur, I'd put on the tongs at his expense. So one night it was raining and the band had to rehearse and Lucille standing out there, you know. And I'd been shooting at her, but she's playing hard to get, you know. So I'm sitting there waiting for Pop Smiley to show up with a tall cat that driver called 30,000 miles. All he do is twist his neck and freshen up again. That's how great he was. So I said, well, look, little girl, you stand out that rain up there and them boys rehearsing. You better get in this car, you know, and the rain was pouring, you know, nothing she could do but in that car. And I took her up in Harlem and like that, and finally dropped off at home. And then another night, the car was running nice there, and I took her home several times. Then we stopped by Mike's, they were all the show people. And you know how you get acquainted like that. Then I asked her, could she cook red beans and rice? And she said, yes. And later she told me she didn't know how to cook no red beans.
Did you teach her?
Oh, no, I'm sure what happened. She went to her mother and they got together. Said, well, this cat wants red beans and rice and we're going to cook him something if you come here tomorrow, you know. So then our mama from Charlottesville, Virginia, she and Lucille would shake up some good thousands on the plate, we used to call them.
You're right.
We used to say they make you 40 years old.
Right.
Anyhow, it was so good, I better save some for the next night, you know, and I'm getting in there. And you go on and on, you know how two people meet. And finally we did Devance. It was great.
Yeah. It's been a great love story.
Yeah, it's been 30 years ago almost. And we've been right in that neighborhood where we live now in Corona. seen three generations right in that one block.
Grow up. I saw some pictures of you with the little children in the neighborhood.
And they all bring their children, their grandchildren, Uncle Louis, Aunt Lucille. See what I mean?
Do you have a big rig, stereo rig in the house? Do you have a collection of your records tapes?
Oh, every record I've made and interviews. I got tapes strung out on my wall in my den for 40 years, right there, all over the world, Africa and everywhere. And I'm just not getting around to them. The 2 years I was off. So when I got out of the hospital, Lucille had one of them tan bags put up there with two tapes together for my present, coming home present.
Oh, that's nice.
And that made me well right there, because I look at all these tapes I begin to hear. I got every show that my idol, Julie LaVanka, had ever made. And she made many of them on the radio.
You and she were great friends.
She had all the great stars on her shows. Yeah. I have messages, like if I'm in Boston, they got a big affair for me or something like that. She always sent her little 2 cents on the tape, her speech and everything, got all that stuff. My life story is right on that wall. Just not getting around to it.
You get a chance to sit home and listen
sometimes.
Yeah,
I've been home 2 years and I haven't finished but 2 shelves. And it's about 20 shelves up to the ceiling. So I got a lot of listening to do yet.
That's very good. You got a lot of playing to do.
And I index them.
Oh, you do? So,
yes. The girl that works for us, she types, she's indexing. I mean, I give her a job and everything. Right now I got my index book with me and all my reels that I've finished. Big old book like that. So I wasn't bored at all, you know. And then I put it down and I got sleepy.
When did you pick up the mouthpiece and start working out a little bit again?
Well,
when you came out of the hospital?
I never did stop. The doctor gave me a chance to warm up, say, about an hour before I eat my dinner. But to play out in the public, you know, he said, you don't want to do that because your heart ain't strong enough to do that. You see, I had kidney ailment and it affected my heart. And then a long time before I wouldn't stop drinking, and that messed up my livers and messed up the medication. You know what I mean? I do it all myself.
And we all do that.
So, yeah. So he said, I'm gonna leave it up to you now. You have to cut out either one or the other. I'm gonna give you a break. You cut out drinking or quit smoking. You know? Well, I mean, just to look at a cigarette and puff it kind of pacified me better than the drinking. I only drank just to. You know, to be with the crowd, to keep from being called a wallflower. And I found myself stumbling over chairs and doing a whole lot of crazy things. So I cut out drinking. And that's the way it is. And I commenced to heal and getting well all the time. And but I never did stop playing at home.
You worked out every day before dinner.
Keep them chops up, man.
Well, I was amazed when I heard those first strains of Sleepy Time Down South on opening night. Wow.
That's right, and they're getting stronger. 2 years, you know. See, blowing at home is nice too, it helps. But when you get out there with that band behind you, and you put a little more effort, you know, and that's what he didn't want. He wanted to bring a big stroller and stuff down to the hospital. He said, "Now I'll let you put on your record, and you just make out your playing." I said, "No, Daddy, you got to put that iron on them chops. You gonna make out nothing." So. When we started rehearsing at my house, he and our company doctor, Dr. Schiff, they were my audience. And every time we finished rehearsal, you know, he got them, what them things you put to your heart and listen.
And checked out your heart?
Yeah.
And checked your blood pressure?
If it didn't work, I wouldn't have been there, because if he said no, that was it.
Were you a little nervous
opening
night?
Nervous.
Didn't bother you at all?
Huh? Nervous. Oh,
Were you ever in your life?
No, man.
How about that first time that you went to work with Joe King Oliver in Chicago? Were you nervous then?
No, well, it wasn't a question of nervous, but when I got to the door, them guys was blowing so good, you know what I mean? And I hadn't heard them play down in New Orleans like that. I said, well, maybe I better not go in or something like that. I think I can fit in this band or something like that. See, and Joe missed the train because he had to go to work, so the red cab brought me to the place. That's when I heard him blowing. I said, maybe I'm not good enough for that band. Somebody went and got Joe Oliver. And he come out and said, man, if you don't come in, you'll... That's my life, you know?
Well, you know...
But I'm never nervous about what...
When you left Chicago, you went to New York and you were with Fletcher Henderson for a time.
Just another band.
Then you went back to Chicago.
Well, I can tell you my thoughts of that band, because when I left Chicago, we was blowing, you know, them bands, like the Little Granite Blood That Died was so good, and Paul Mares and them boys, they were playing good music. So when I went into Fletcher's band, I saw a lot of music, a bunch of cats. The first time I saw a lot of music on the stand and different things like that. And I walked in and every summer, look, I had nobody say nothing, you know. I said, well, maybe that's the way they're supposed to act. And I went up to Fletcher, and he's sharp, you know. He come out of university and all that old BS. I said, Mr. Anderson, I'm Lou Armstrong, and you sent for me to come out of Chicago to play in a band, which he tried to get me about 2 years earlier in New Orleans, and I wouldn't take the job on the kind he didn't take my drummer, Zooty Singleton. Don't forget that.
Yeah, great.
I'd have been in the band, probably been a better deal if it had taken me then, but he wouldn't take Zooty, but he kept on, and I left Chicago to join the band. So when I went to him and told him, I said, I'm the Lord Strong, he said, oh yeah, that's the way he laid on me. Oh yeah, I said, your part is up there. I said, part? I ain't had no part before in my life. Part other than the brass band, you know. What the hell are you talking about? So he meant, my part is up, they waiting to play. And the first thing they played was Minnetonka, which was a beautiful thing. So he gives me the third trumpet part, you know.
Yeah.
I could read because I was playing them funeral marches and you know that, and brass band. So I went up there and went down and showed it sound pretty, you know. Still ain't no somebody said nothing to me. I said to myself, you bunch of hinky cats. I'm getting evil now myself. Put that Liberty and Vedita on them there, you know. Yeah, I can get hinky too, you know what I mean. So anyhow, they put out another arrangement and it was finally Kaiser, the drummer. He looked down at my shoes. He said, man, what you doing with them high-top shoes on? I started telling him what to do. You know? And they just razzing me finally. I look around, there was Don Redman in the band and Kaiser Marshall, Old Green with the trombone, they had a hell of a band. And Cuba, the bass man.
Yeah, you know, Cuba, right.
Always arguing with Green, where Green would be playing his part, and Cuba would hold over the bass and cut Green's part for him, and they'd get the organ. I said, this is a good band. I like this guy. And Cuba would say, you sound busy, I cut the S. So you can be half. That's all right, yeah. And when you look around, I didn't wedge in that band, and that's when they're supposed to get the saxophone player from Cleveland. I forget his name, he's supposed to be a hell of a man. But he had a job and he couldn't make it, and I just had left Erskine Tate with Buster Bailey in the band. That's how he got in Fletcher's band. Uh-huh. I said, well, I just left a fine saxophone player. And they said, well, go get him. And then Buster joined the band. And that's how he got in. So that made Buster Bailey, Coleman Hawkins, and Don Redman.
Ooh.
They wasn't using but three sax in those days. Boy, what is it?
Coleman Hawkins.
Yeah.
Great player.
Yeah, he was young then. Blowing.
I saw Coleman on 52nd Street during the war years. And Red Allen had a band, and Henry Red, and New York, and J.C. Higginbottom.
Yeah, well, that's
and Don Stovall, that was later.
Stovall was good.
Yeah. And
with them cats, I don't know, as they go along, I look at it and say, why did they have to drink so much to blow the horn? See, now when I got full of whiskey, I just put the horn down, because I couldn't even find the mouthpiece. You think you're red now.
Yeah, that's
and
the whole
I never liked to play my horn full of lush.
Yeah,
and I ain't seen nobody else that could play with it.
Yeah, you think you do, but you don't.
I ain't seen nobody do nothing decent with a stomach full of whiskey. Nothing.
That's for true. That's for true.
You know that.
Yeah.
Some of your best musicians, I mean, they had to go because they drank too much.
Yeah, it's all in their mind, but they're not doing it.
They think they're raising hell.
Yeah.
But they ain't doing nothing, man. I'd prefer seeing a band play full of gauge because they concentrate. And they got a clean mind, and they think of things of enlightening. You know the difference?
Right.
And I've seen a bunch of cats sitting around the room, like we sitting here, and that cat's blowing that good shit, shuts it, you know?
Yeah.
And a woman would come in with another cat that belongs, you know, that hangs out around, And every cat would stand up. Gentlemen.
Right.
Cut Sir Walter Raleigh. See what I mean? But let that same bunch of cats sit there full of lush, one of them go hit on her ass.
Right.
And there's your big fight. See the difference? I can see the difference.
Sure.
I've seen musicians play better with Gage than liquor. They ain't played nothing yet with whiskey. So that's my story.
Louis?
That's why I always appreciated Gage the whole time that I could get a good big stick.
Okay.
Never did down it. I don't care what anybody think and what people did. I paid my dues and we got busted and everything, like Big Burton, the best drum in Hollywood and all that. And them's fine people, and respect. And we would lighten up before even the movie stars knew what it was. They thought I was living with a woman called Mary Warner.
Mary Warner.
Yeah.
Right.
Take that. And the last letter I wrote to Max Jones in England, we was talking about it. After all, I ain't got nothing to hide. And I won't let no somebody come by 5 years from now with extortion eyes. Oh, no, I tell them where to wipe it and get some Swiss twist to wipe it with. Cause it's too late. Now, in the story, I says, Marijuana, darling, I loved you all of my life and always have the greatest respect for you. But law-wise, it's got so disgusting now. When we was lighting up, it was called misdemeanor. You understand?
Right, a misdemeanor.
Yeah, well, that. I said, but it seems, though, you have lost your misto. And through the years, it done got meaner and meaner, so I didn't put you down. But I mean, in those days, I mean, they did everything decent and respect for people. And
no nice, problems.
And the nicest things. I remember one time we pulled up in Baltimore at the Rod Theater. Well, you call them ghettos now. We call it Negro neighborhood. Poor people. And then the summer's there, heat, shivering and frozen, you know what I mean? And they told me this before we even were going to rehearsal at the Royal Theater on Pennsylvania Avenue. I said, well, we straightened that. Went out to the coal yard and got a whole ton of coal and made that man dump it right in the lobby. And you see them cats with their buckets getting that coal and smiling. And
taking it home.
That's what I'm talking about. Full of whiskey, you say, you get the hell away, took some coal in them, you probably hit somebody with it. You understand? And everybody was happy. And my second day, going on the stage, here's a little white kid, about 16, 17, 17 years old. And he come out dressing room. I mean, you know, everybody's always welcome with vipers, they call
them. Right.
You know, if you didn't smoke kids, if you're around them, you still, they'll catch will take a drag and pass it to you. Now, if you don't like, say no thanks. That's it. You know, next fella, you know? So anyway, this kid, just as I was going on the stage, he said, Pops, say, my grandmother is about to bore me to death. I said, what's wrong? He said, well, it seems though she's so restless and she can't sleep. Then I come to you, maybe you can give me a good idea how to pacify it. See what's wrong, you know. And the man done hollered, hold on, it's time for pale moonshine. I said, tell your grandmother to take a big stick of Gage and a good physic and go to bed and sleep peacefully. And I went, you know what I mean? And 2 days later, this boy come back smiling. He said, Pops, it worked. And I looked at myself, I said, well, I'll be damned.
Dr. Pops.
Yeah. That boy was so happy. They're about to drive him nuts.
What comes from here? Do you have concert engagements coming after?
Well, you got to take it in stride as far as I'm concerned. The first thing I got to do, we got to go to New York and let Joker check up. Because we almost, you know, had to hog time to consent to come to this engagement.
Right. So now he wants to check you and see how you are.
The first thing was the thing in the first thing when we had the concert in California, yeah. When they had that big cake and all that, I mean, we had to beg him to let me ride a plane. He didn't think I was well enough to go out there. And before that was Philadelphia, wasn't it? Yeah. See what I mean? Say, why should you give up such a coming along nice? And, so we had to prove that to him. So this turned out so far, it turned out. And then the California turned out. And Mike Douglas show, we went down big limousines and everything, but right to his office after that, said it coming along nice. And the last thing he said, didn't he? Don't overdo it. He was sitting there, him and Zucker.
You know what I hope we can do, Pops? I hope we can get it on. And I know you're going to be here at the Tropicana during the Christmas holidays, yes. But I'd like to see this coming spring, 71, you and Ella.
Well, I mean, that's
together.
Up to you.
No, we're going to go to
work. Well, I mean, not to you. I mean, the people that's got it in mind, the people that's running these places. I can't, like I told this Russian port, what you call him?
Ilya
Tevchenko.
Well, now, this is a fact. You see, he come in my dressing room, and he's in his entourage, you know. And he's fine, cat's fine. That's what's happening. I said, yeah, Daddy, what's happening there? He said, we want you to come to Russia. He said, we want you to open up in Siberia. I said, man, Siberia is cold as chest as, you know what I mean? He said, don't worry, they have a lot of babies there and swarm somewhere there. You know? And I said, well, you tell Oshenko to get it together and stop BSing so much. That's right.
So you're just going to take it a step at a time?
Well, I mean, that's up to them. I mean, I'm straight. No more, no less. I'm still going to warm up every day and if the mood for myself.
You got the index? And you got the index to work on.
And I send out photographs and I write letters. And after all, we got to take inventory at home, me and Lucille, and little things. You know. Well, so we're straight. You don't need a whole lot to keep. That's the trouble with a lot of people. They think they're missing something. That's the trouble with a lot of musicians. That goes with me, too, on them one-nighters. Sometimes it takes us 3 hours in the morning to get to the airport. And you can hang around there all day because the plane's late or broke down or something. And when he decides to take you, you get to the town just in time to play the concert. Sometimes we don't have time to get a meal.
Just go right to the stage.
Go right to the stage, and we did it. One time in Paris, we had to hang around and get stoned, telling lies, and just enough room for two. And we went way down in Algiers somewhere. Went right on the stage. Tunis. Went right on the stage. You understand?
And did it.
So I had no smoke. I can do all that now. I can still go back to that mule because I feel I'm a good man. A whole lot of things we don't have to do. Ain't nobody but Lucille and myself.
Yeah.
We don't need billions and trillions. You understand?
That's very simple.
And you know she took good care of me.
Yeah.
Because the day they called her from the hospital, said, Lucille, bring Lou Armstrong some Swiss crisps because he won't food that other stuff. He said, it makes him sput like a motorboat. And she brought a whole contraband of that Swiss crisps down there, little packages. And in 3 days, all the nurses and the patients, everybody was jumping over huddles and happy.
Well, you know,
I won't call the name of what they take, and you know what they give you in hospital.
Yeah.
And now, Jesus Christ.
Swiss Chris cuts that.
Cuts
everything.
And
don't light any matches in the morning. That was your advice in the note that you sent me with a pack of Swiss Chris. You said, don't strike any matches
well,
in the morning.
Anyway. Yeah, you ever tried?
Oh, yeah.
And I always tell people, if they take Swiss Chris, and nothing happened, they get their money back.
I remember that you went to the Asuntos home here in Las Vegas, and Betty and Jody had a Swiss Quiz party.
They sure did. She never forgot it, too. I gave a cat, now you know like some cats, they like it so well. Like one of the cats, we was lighting up at the on Central Avenue way back then, 1930, man. Just two of us. And casually went to Swiss Chris time with me. I don't care who I'm talking to. Mop, put it on my tongue and rinse it down. Number the herbs anyway, you know? So this guy said, what are you doing there, Bobby? Give me some of that. I said, well, that's just my little laxative. I came myself out. He said, give me some of that, man. So I said, okay, and I gave him a great big tablespoonful, put it on his tongue, he rinsed it down, and then we had a highball and fast, and they paid no attention to it. And that's how easy it is to take. So I don't see him for about 2 weeks later, and it was at the drugstore where we hang out, you know what I mean? And I was eating a sandwich, and he come in the door, so there's my man, what's that, daddy? And this time he looked at me straight in the face. He said, man, if I'd have seen you the next night, I'd have cut your goddamn throat. He said, but I felt good. I said, well, thank God for that. He was so mad with me, he didn't realize he had to trot so much, you know? But he said, I felt good, you know?
Louis,
we had a lot of fun in life. It's all around music.
It's 54 years you've been making people feel good all over the world.
The people that make me feel good, they appreciate my music, my life, you know what I mean? Even the time I was playing in California there where Vic and I was out in this lot, you know, we just in the mission having a ball lighting up, and two big detectives walked out and said, well, I'll take the Roach Boys, and we mug and say, how are something like that, and they say, I can get you all 6 months for the Roach. I said, well, don't do me no damn favors.
Hold on, Pops, and then we're going to sign off. I have enjoyed sitting with you.
Yeah.
And I look forward to seeing you over the Christmas holidays.
Yeah, well you know, we're going to play our old stomping grounds.
Tropicana with Maynard.
See, well, I like up there because we have more time. We can do a little more, and they hold you down to a lot of places like this. You got to have so many minutes to do this. But down there, they give us a little more time. And I like it very much.
Thank you very much, Louis Armstrong.
Okay, buddy. Thank you. Always glad to dig you.
Our pleasure.
Yeah.
Dig you.
And you being a trumpet player, you know.
Yeah, bad trumpet player.
That's all right. As long as it's bad or good.
I did my best.
You know how to hold one anyway.
You're right.
A whole lot of people know how to hold a trumpet. I was coming on the boat from Paris, and this society woman, they give you prizes, and then somebody told her, Louis Armstrong on the boat, and oh, God, she trilled over there. She said, Mr. Armstrong, I heard you was on the boat, and you play the saxophone so well, I'll put you on. Thank you very much.
I finally found one person in the whole world that didn't know that you played the trumpet.
No, you kidding?
What, Doc?
What's the lady in London you gave your trumpet to?
MacDougall or MacDonald or somebody.
Lady?
Mr.
She's, Rowdy.
That's right. MacDonald or MacDougall, one of them. She was related.
Give her a trumpet?
She was related to the Queen. Yeah, and she called me up and blow every morning, play something for me. Yeah, you meet all kind of people like that.
You've met all kind of people.
Yeah, and I had an English boy that was kind of my dresser, like, you know. Well, he's got that airs over there. Well, I just come off the stage, you know, and everybody's gait or what you say. But this cat, he'd put it on strong. I'm laying on the couch, and this cat would come to the door, Mr. Armstrong, Lord Dushmont was there. I said, man, let the man come in. And this cat, he's glad he come in and click them heels. And first thing he said, well, what about Bix? I said, stash, man, let's talk.
And we've been talking.
Yeah, you want to know if Bix still alive and all them kind of things.
Thank you very much, Pops.
Okay, buddy. Anytime.
Okay.